Hello, I'm Merrick Snyder. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, "On Valentine's Day, I Want to Hold Your Invisible Hand," by Roland Fryer. Brenda Cronin wrote, "A Human Wrote This Article." Then Alan Woodward has, "How Your Brain Recovers from Sleep Deprivation." We'll follow that up with an article by Jordan McGillis, "Why the Middle Class Feels Poor." And we'll have one more by Mike Kerrigan, "True Love is the Stuff That Works." All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one. On Valentine's Day, I want to hold your invisible hand. After 15 years of marriage, I decided to prove that I still knew how to be romantic. So I took my wife out to dinner on February 14th. Which is to say, I paid the highest possible price for the lowest expected quality. The restaurant was packed, the service strained, the kitchen overwhelmed, the film spectacular. A romantic episode felt mass-produced as if affection were being pushed through Adam Smith's Pin Factory. We were seated, smiled at, served, then rushed along. By the end, both of us felt slightly nauseated, though not by the food. After precious few nights out without our kids, we had willingly suspended our better judgment, only to be reminded, extensively, that there are better ways to signal how you feel. That is what makes Valentine's Day irresistible as an object of economic analysis. The same forces that produce traffic jams and market bubbles, congestion, imperfect information, coordination failures, are at work here too, only with candles. On the surface, Valentine's Day is about affection. In practice, it behaves like a market shock. Demand compresses into a single evening and prices rise accordingly. Going out often costs substantially more than on a regular night, and at fine dining restaurants, prices can rise by 50% to 70%, driven by price fix menus and service fees. Flowers see even steeper markups, often selling for 2 to 3 times their usual price. Congestion is a classic externality. Each additional couple imposes a small cost on every other couple. Yet most American adults participate anyway. The National Retail Federation estimates that Americans who observe Valentine's Day spent a record $27.5 billion on the holiday back in 2025, about $189 each, with spending projected to have risen in 2026. That puts Valentine's Day ahead of Easter, but behind Mother's Day. Why do we spend money on precisely the day when these goods and services are most expensive? The human answer is loyal, love. The economics answer points to something love constantly struggles with, verification. Feelings are private. You can tell your partner you're committed, and you may even mean it, but the truth is not directly observable. That makes romance vulnerable to the same problem that bedevils almost every economic transaction, imperfect information. Like many social institutions, Valentine's Day solves an invisible problem with visible behavior. It sets a date, creates shared expectations, and forces action, turning feelings into receipts. Higher prices don't eliminate the congestion, they become part of the signal. Why does verification have to happen on a specific day? Valentine's Day functions as a coordination device. Couples face a recurring problem. They agree that something special should happen, But without a deadline, the plan gets delayed, diluted, or forgotten. Life offers a thousand competing obligations, and romance, despite what movies suggest, is often the first to lose a scheduling battle. When society selects a date, however, that date becomes self-enforcing. A single Valentine's Day also creates comparability. Romantic effort becomes legible not only to your partner, but often to a broader social world. Getting into an impossible-to-book restaurant isn't merely dinner. It signals planning, cost, and priorities. That same mechanism has a darker side. New information can expose problems as easily as it can reassure. This helps explain why Valentine's Day is often followed by relationship churn. Survey data suggests that roughly 13% of United States adults report ending a relationship on or immediately after the holiday. Search activity spikes for phrases like, should I break up? And dating platforms report elevated reactivations in the days that follow. Valentine's Day does not necessarily cause these breakups. It compresses information. What might otherwise linger as low-grade uncertainty is confirmed all at once. Not every couple places the same importance on Valentine's Day. Some celebrate a month later when prices are lower. As one would expect, these tend to be more stable relationships with less need for the kind of information Valentine's Day is designed to produce. Survey evidence bears this out. Data from LendingTree so that Valentine's Day spending is highest where relationship uncertainty is greatest. Couples together for less than 2 years report planned spending of roughly $369, compared with about $207 among those together for 2 to 5 years, $187 among those together 5 to 10 years, and just $118 among couples together more than a decade. As relationships accumulate history, shared routines, mutual investments, reputational collateral, the need for dramatic, deadline-driven proof declines. Valentine's Day does not disappear, but its function changes. What begins as verification becomes ceremony. Why, then, would secure couples celebrate the day at all, given the hassle and expense? The ceremonial value of Valentine's Day lies in its role as what economists call a cooling equilibrium. Couples in very different situations behave the same way. Couples participate not only when they need reassurance, but also because opting out invites interpretation. Even in strong relationships, deviation creates noise, and noise is costly. The shared benchmark keeps everyone in the pool. If only troubled couples celebrated Valentine's Day, participation itself would become a signal and the institution would defeat its own purpose. This holiday persists because it produces credible evidence and makes effort comparable. Sometimes the least efficient dinner of the year is doing something dinner was never meant to do. Turn love into proof. And now a human wrote this article. Press or help me write, the prompt reads every time I begin an email. No, thank you. I can draft a message, and I'm guessing people who know me can distinguish my prose from a bot. But for how long? Given how fast artificial intelligence is developing, it probably already can, with the right prompts, write a novel in the voice of Jane Austen, Henry James, or Ernest Hemingway. AI is here, and even those on the frontier seem uncertain whether it is our savior or doom. Anthropic CEO and co-founder Dario Amodo recently cited horrifying scenarios if the technology falls into malevolent hands. Others have exulted that AI will free us from busy work, and perhaps all work entirely. What if I am ill at ease with leisure? What if I like drafting that email or doing the task AI will take over? It seems that stuffing AI models with every scrap of knowledge leaves them spiritually bereft. Perhaps this is because religion does not seem to be among the ingredients that contemporary Victor Frankenstein are using to cook up and refine their creations. So will the result be a country of geniuses in a data center, as Mr. Amodel put it, without a single soul among them? Playing God is what law firm and investment bank bigwigs used to call their tasks jokingly when voting each year on a new class of partners. Not making partner, getting tenure, or landing a crucial promotion is consequently professionally for most, it's consequential professionally for most people. But such moments are not performance life-altering, and the partners and faculty members were not actually wielding the authority of a deity. AI creators are trying to generate not only thinking productive entities, but ones that blaze past mortals in every respect. How horrifying to think of all that capability and intellect unmoored from a conscience. These brilliant entities begin elbowing aside plodding humans. Where does that leave us? Why bother attempting a task, say, writing an essay, if a bot can do it much better and faster? But a work of art requires inspiration. Is that being fostered in AI models? What about enterprise, empathy, curiosity, and pluck? If AI models begin lapping humans in most endeavors, then where will we find purpose? Unlike synthetic entities, humans are capable of faith, which infuses life with meaning. I'm no Luddite, though I did cling to my BlackBerry with its winning Lipitudian keyboard, surrendering reluctantly to an iPhone only when the BlackBerry became extinct. It took a worldwide pandemic to shift me to paying bills online. It's easier, but writing checks every month was a sobering reminder of where my money was going. Filling out the line after pay to the order of with Verizon or American Express gave the payment a dimension beyond the monopoly money world of a few clicks on my checking account. Long ago, I began outsourcing, although to humans, tedious tasks such as preparing my taxes. I'm happy to unload more to AI, although it isn't clear I need a country of geniuses to book my JetBlue flight. I welcome their help. But writing, for now at least, I've got this. And now, how your brain recovers from sleep deprivation. Scientists have new insight into why we have trouble focusing after a bad night of sleep. Attention lapses when we're sleep deprived result from our brain's efforts to clean itself up, a process that usually happens during sleep, recent research found. Typically at night, a fluid that surrounds our brain flushes out toxins, cell debris, and junk proteins that build up during the day. This cleansing helps curb inflammation and keeps the brain working properly. If we don't sleep well, our brain tries to compensate while we're awake, triggering pulses of fluid that coincide with sharp reductions in attention lasting a few seconds, according to a recent study published in Nature Neuroscience. It's this kind of very sleep-like moment, said Laura Lewis, an associate professor of electrical and medical engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and co-author of the study. The person is awake, but at the same time, there's clearly this brief breakdown of ability to focus on the outside world. The research indicates the brain has two different modes. One is housekeeping, and the other is being awake, and they are not compatible, according to Dr. Mikan Nedegaard, a professor of neuroscience at the University of Rochester Medical School, who was not involved in this work. Getting enough sleep is linked to many health benefits, including better metabolism and lower risk of heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, and type 2 diabetes. While some can handle a disrupted sleep schedule better than others, all sleep-deprived people who participated in the study experienced this effect, Lewis said. The risks associated with these failures to focus, like car crashes, can be high, she said. This suggests that there's really some very urgent function of sleep the brain is trying to get that's worth this cost, she added. Lewis's group examined 26 people between the ages of 19 and 40 who had no history of sleep disorders. Participants were tested twice, once when well-rested and once after staying awake all night. During each experiment, they received a functional MRI scan to help the researchers track the movement of fluid out of the brain. Participants also wore a cap monitoring brain activity while they completed attention tasks. Sleep-deprived participants had slower reactions or missed visual and auditory cues. During these misses, the scientists observed a surge of cerebrospinal fluid through and out of the brain. Participants' heart rates and their breathing slowed. Something is happening, not just in the brain, but kind of in the whole body, Lewis said. This suggests there's likely one circuit that switches us between high attention and low attention states. Fluid surges while we are awake are not identical to those during sleep, she added. They're shorter and start and stop. Other studies have shown the waste products in the fluid are absorbed into the bloodstream surrounding the brain, which eventually takes them to the kidneys and liver, where they are removed from the body. Monitoring the brain's self-regulation and maintenance functions, like this fluid flushing, are opportunities for new diagnostic tools and avenues for treatment, Nedergaard says. Sleep disturbances precede most neurodegenerative diseases by up to decades, she added. We really start to look at sleep as an opportunity to prevent many of the diseases of aging. Now, why the middle class feels poor? Middle class families don't feel as secure as they once did. It is not because the poverty line is really $140,000, as Michael Green claimed in a viral essay. Yet the impoverished feeling he describes among people who are too prosperous for public support but cannot afford many luxuries has validity. It is due to what I call the Great Decompression. The Great Decompression is the phenomenon of incomes rising across the board, but much faster for families above the median. The upper middle class has done better than stay one step ahead. Families with income at the 80th percentile and above are pulling away in lifestyle and social status, opening a chasm that separates them significantly from families with median incomes. It has not always been this way. The mid-20th century was an era of middle-class expansion. In the first three post-war decades, workers below the median saw their wages grow faster than workers above the median did. Economists Claudia Golden and Robert Marco labeled this dynamic the Great Compression. Since about 1975, though, we've been in an era of upward escape for families with the right human and social capital, which has become even more valuable with the rise of digital technology and globalization. As a result, the upper middle class is running away from the pack. The great decompression we're experiencing is obvious to the naked eye, and especially on Instagram, but intensifying income stratification is also visible in the data. It is especially clear in the growing gap between the median family income and the 80th percentile family income, often considered the gateway to the upper middle class. The 80th percentile, more than the 90th or the 99th, shows something important. The broad class of educated everyday professionals significantly outpacing the median are setting a standard that median income families cannot keep up with. As per the Integrated Public Use Microdata Series, where married couples with children, the kind of families Mr. Green wrote about, the median income in 1975 was $15,000. The 80th percentile for married couples with children was $22,600. Put another way, the 80th percentile family earned 51% more than the median family. Since then, the distance between the median and the 80th percentile has grown. In 2000, the median married couple with children earned $59,000, while the 80th percentile family earned $99,000, meaning the 80th percentile family was earning 68% more. By last year, the gap had grown even more substantial, with the median married couple with children earning $130,000 and the 80th percentile family, also a married couple with children, earning $242,000, 85% more. Mr. Green's analysis implies that today's average American family is in poverty. That is not true. What those families experience is the intuitive but accurate sense that they're losing ever more ground to the upper middle class. Optimists argue that these changes are fine, maybe even good. People are getting richer, some faster than others. Yet as sociologists Richard Reeves, Robert Putnam, and others have argued for a decade, the claim that decompression is a healthy part of a robust economy becomes less persuasive when taking generational trends into account. The faster wealth building of the upper middle class in recent decades has been accompanied by a sort of mating and what Mr. Reeves described as the upper middle class hoarding of the American dream. These days, upper middle class kids don't only have more spending money, they have different neighborhoods, different schools, different horizons. In the jargon of economists, absolute economic mobility remains strong, but it does not necessarily translate to relative mobility. Basic material needs of Americans are more fully met today than they were 50 years ago. But without more opportunity for social advancement, a large portion of American families are bound to feel they are missing out. $140,000 is nowhere near poverty. But the Great Decompression has so enlarged the prosperity of the upper middle class that the middle class cannot be blamed for thinking the American dream is slipping away. And now we do have one more. True love is the stuff that works. My wife and I rarely disagree, but we do in one area of particular interest on Valentine's Day. The love song that I think best celebrates her. It took a while for me to settle on the perfect ballad. When we first began dating, I liked Joe Jackson's catchy 1979 hit, Is She Really Going Out With Him? It dryly captured my sense of immense good fortune that such a beauty had signed on with me. Later, I switched to Some Kind of Wonderful by Grand Funk Railroad for a simple reason. Whenever she's around, my heart beats in rhythm with the 1974 tune's powerful drum lead-in. But some years back, I happened on the perfect, although unorthodox, love song, Stuff That Works, by virtuoso singer-songwriter Guy Clark. In the best tradition of country music, his 1995 masterpiece is the proverbial three chords and the truth. My wife's objection is not one of degree, but rather of kind. She says it isn't a proper love song. She's wrong. Sure, it praises what is old and of that more things, blue shirts, guitars, boots, and used cars than people. When making the amorous case this admittedly is, at first glance, risky evidence. But great poetry deserves more than a glance. Texas troubadour is celebrating not what's withered and worn, but authentic and real. These unchanging things have intrinsic value and beauty that time cannot touch and that grow with age. Mr. Clark states his greater and greatest love, his best friend and the woman he loves respectfully, for last. His beloved is described as having a playground sense of justice. She won't take odds. John Keith could not have better described a woman whose love is true, headlong, self-emptying, and completely other-directed. I've felt such a woman's love for more than 30 years. That's why Stuff That Works is a love song. And as the Marshall Tucker Band has established, if you've heard it in a love song, it cannot be wrong. This Valentine's Day, with all due respect to Elvis Presley and Etta James, consider dedicating an unorthodox song of your own to your beloved. You might find it is not that unorthodox after all. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.